And without further ado, please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome for Dan Gilbert and Adam Silver.
Didn't start off good. This thing just fell, but I'll be all right. So, Commissioner, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Is it strange for people to call you Commissioner? I mean, that's like a... Only people I know in Commissioner are head of leagues or in Batman when right. He used to,
It's strange. It's a title. It's like for anybody like to call Vice President of Sales, Commissioner.
But Commissioner, is there any history on Commissioner? Do we know who was the first league to use that word was Commissioner?
I'm pretty sure it was baseball.
Oh, it was baseball. Yeah. And the other leagues just followed.
Because our league is so much younger anyway. Our league is, roughly 7 years old. So we're by far and away the youngest of the major.
So, dinner reservations, do you say Commissioner Silver? Or no? Okay. Just a few little highlights. I know that Steve, what's up, man? And he went ahead and gave us some background on Adam, but just I'm going to give you a little bit more. So, born and raised in the New York City area, correct?
Yes.
Went to Rye High School. Is a Knicks.
Suburbs of New York City.
Suburbs. And is a Knicks fan. And
no,
was
no,
a Knicks
I
was. Fan. Oh. Was a Knicks fan. Okay, but still a fan of Duke University?
Yes, I went to Duke University.
I hear there's a couple guys there, if you get the lottery balls, and they go pretty well for your team. I'm just saying. Okay, you hear that, Arn? Where are you? Okay. Law degree from the University of Chicago after that, and then you practiced law for a few years. Joined the NBA in 1992. You rose up to become deputy commissioner. There's a deputy commissioner, too. And COO under David Stern, the great David Stern, and ultimately became the NBA commissioner by unanimous vote, I believe, or close to it anyway, on February 1st, 2014, probably unanimous. Many accomplishments in 4.5 years, these are just a handful, and I really do mean this. He changed owners on a team just a few months in, which was pretty incredible and a strong leadership by Adam. Negotiated a labor contract, grew the G League, brought in the NBA 2K League, which is, for those of you who know or haven't heard of that esports thing, that's now in basketball, right? New culture, I won't say a new culture, but emerged the culture in the NBA to one that's open, transparent, collaborative, technology-focused, and among other great things. And I got to tell you, just as somebody that it's hard to know if you're an owner, if you work for the commissioner, commissioner works for the owners, but it's really a partnership in all reality. And one of the great guys I've ever personally worked with, and you'll see probably by the end of the interview, you'll probably feel the same way. So I'll formally now introduce Adam Silver.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. So let me just tell everybody. So we actually did this already in Cleveland 2 or 3 weeks ago. So we're thinking about coming out with tour shirts. And I think we're going to be in Memphis and Sacramento But we had a great time in Cleveland, and so I'll ask some of the same questions, but not all of them, because got to ask some new stuff. So let's talk about.
But you got to jump in too and help answer your own questions.
Yeah,
we're in this together. You said we're partners.
Sometimes, yeah. talk to us, or talk to me, or talk to everybody here really about the transition. So David Stern, 30 years, legendary commissioner. Not a quiet guy, has his opinions for sure, but mostly loved by most people, and built something, from here that was, the league, I guess it was in the 80s, early 80s he took over, but the league was still a pretty known big league and internationally known at the time. But you are now taking 30 years past that where, man, how do you step into those shoes, and how did you view it?
Well, we said hello to Dave Bing a minute ago, so one of the NBA greats is here, obviously your former.
Where is
so,
Dave? Where is
where
he?
Dave
oh, we're right here. Hey,
right here. Hi, Dave. So, don't always look right in front of you, and could speak better than we can about the old days in the league. But even when David Stern became commissioner, we still had the finals on tape delay, even in the early 80s. You remember as a fan, if you were on the East Coast, often the finals would take place, in prime time or whatever else. But then at 11:30 at night, you would have to tune in, and obviously for younger people here, pre-internet, pre-sports center, pre a lot of those things. So you didn't even necessarily have access to highlights or the scores until the next day. And I think, you know, I always say, I think David was the perfect person. You know, a little bit about his personality. He's a very, honestly, and I mean this in an endearing way, a very forceful person. And I think that was very much necessary. I mean, he was the general counsel of the league, and he was outside counsel before he was an in-house lawyer and then became commissioner. But I think David had to break a lot of china, so to speak, as a commissioner in the early days, because he felt the league wasn't getting the respect it deserved. And back to your question even about the title, commissioner didn't have the heritage, didn't have the legacy, certainly that Major League Baseball had. And you know, that was, I mean, still maybe many people refer to it as America's pastime, but basketball was viewed as a secondary sport. And I think David was, I think he created a new model for what a commissioner should be, because even, I think I thought before I was involved with the league, I didn't understand really the role of commissioner more as CEO of a business, and that's more what the job is internally. I mean, I think I thought as a fan, especially in the 80s, you know, before I came to the league, you'd see commissioner gave out rings for championships and maybe disciplined players and shook hands at the draft, yeah. But I never understood the commissioner's role in terms of day-to-day operating a large global business. And I think David redefined the role for all of leagues, because he came in, even though his background was as a lawyer, and we both went to law school too, and yeah. Transitioned and became business people.
Right, I wouldn't call me a lawyer though.
Right, I know, me either.
So,
anymore,
yeah, you went to law school. You guys at least did
something. And I think though what David demonstrated is that take best practices in business, the kind of thing that Dan teaches, frankly, to his employees in all his businesses, and those same practices are tried and true for sports as well. And I think, you know, you've seen by virtue of owning a team that it's not always what people may see from the outside, because you're going to be measured in wins and losses. But even when it comes to building culture, you know, on the field or on the floor or whatever else, it's still sound management, hiring good people, making difficult decisions.
This is a good time for us to definitely judge us from the inside, being 2-11 or 2-12 or whatever we are.
Timing
is perfect on that one. Yeah.
And then in terms of your question about the transition, to me, I had the benefit of working directly for David. The last job I was in before I became commissioner was deputy commissioner, but deputy commissioner was my fourth job at the NBA before I became commissioner. And as you said, so it was, you know, roughly 21 years of working directly for David. Actually started, I after law school, I clerked for a judge, worked for a law firm for a few years, and then went to work for David. And
how did that happen, just out of curiosity? David Stern called you one day and said,
no, I wrote him a letter. Yeah. My father was a lawyer at the same firm that David had worked at in New York, Proskauer Rose. And I didn't know David, but I wrote him a letter when I was an associate from Crevasse, Wayne & Moore in New York, not thinking I would ever end up at the NBA. And again, this was pre-internet. It wasn't easy to find out a lot about a business, especially ones where there wasn't a book somewhere that you could buy and it would explain what an org chart at a basketball league was. And I think even then, when I wrote him the letter, it was sort of early days of the NBA's move into cable television. And the law firm I was at, I was doing a lot of work on media matters. We were representing Time Warner. And I wrote David a letter. It was one of those letters saying, you know my father, and I'm a young lawyer. I know that you made the transition from law into business. If you ever had any time to talk to me, I would appreciate it. And I went over, it took 2 months to get in to see him. And it wasn't an interview. He gave me 45 minutes of his time or so and gave me some advice. Yeah. And then it wasn't until some time later that, I mean, it's a much longer story, but he then called me back a few months later and said, so what'd you ever end up doing? And I was still working at the law firm, and he said, I got an idea, come back and see me. And I ended up getting hired as his special assistant. So that's how I ended up at the NBA.
So that was before email, texting. Remember when everybody had time to do those things?
Exactly.
That was great.
It was no email whatsoever.
Now we talked about the past and the present. We'll come back to the present day, but let's talk about the future of the NBA. So internationally and otherwise, compared, let's say, to the other three or four major sports in not only the United States, but the world, football, baseball, hockey, and soccer, how does the NBA fit in that as far as its future growth internationally, domestically, and anywhere else?
You know, I'd say so. If you sit, for example, and talk to the shoe companies like Nike and Adidas, they would say, in the grand scheme of things, there are two global sports, soccer and basketball. And soccer, obviously known as football outside the United States, is still bigger in totality than basketball. But the NBA is a singular league, is probably the biggest league in the world, because for those who are soccer fans, there's multiple top-notch international soccer leagues. I was just talking to a gentleman here from Germany about the Bundesliga in Germany, or there's the, you know, La Liga in Spain, or you know, the EPL in England. In the case of basketball, there's really no competition, and I think everyone acknowledges around the world, even though there's other leagues, that if you grow up in Shanghai or in Detroit or Cleveland and you play basketball, your dream is to play in the NBA. And increasingly with girls, the dream is to play in the WNBA.
How many, I'm sorry to interrupt, but how many countries are represented now by a player in the NBA?
Roughly, it's like 42 approximately. We have 25% of our league now is are made up of players born outside the United States, representing roughly, I think, around 42 countries. And I think for us, you know, the opportunity is still enormous because, of course, for anyone in this room who's in a global business, the United States population is less than 5% of the global population. So, I mean, just by way of example, I was over in China for two preseason games between the 76ers and the Dallas Mavericks, and different teams go every year for these preseason games. And on a Friday night in October, a preseason game in Shanghai, we were carried on two different networks, CCTV in China and Tencent, which is a streaming service. You know, over 50 million people on a Friday night in China watched a preseason game. So, you know, the opportunity for growth, I mean, because we're seeing increasing, you know, it's not just international players in the league, but they're stars, you know, and look at the young, you know, I was just in Philly Friday night, Ben Simmons in Philadelphia, you know, from Australia, or Joel Embiid from Cameroon, Africa, you know, Giannis in Milwaukee. I mean, there's the caliber of the international players is obviously as good as players coming, you know, from the United States or anywhere for that matter. And it's almost as if you can flip a switch in a lot of those markets. I mean, we were growing in popularity in China before Yao Ming came in. And one of the advantages we have is by virtue of being an Olympic sport and a sport that plays off-season the Olympics, so unlike the NHL, which has to decide whether or not to stop competition. You know, we've been an Olympic sport since 1936. And so basketball's been played in China for a long time, but when Yao Ming came into the NBA, the growth curve sort of hockey stick-like, you know, just zoomed up. And what was interesting, a lot of people predicted when Yao Ming retired that then the popularity would decline, and it's only increased exponentially that much more because the big stars in the NBA, regardless of where they're from, have become big stars in China as well.
Let's switch gears to the balance of the league and compare it to the other leagues. So in other words, seems to me, and this is one of these hard questions, you know how that goes, but we're going to get to the hard questions in a nice way, of course. So basketball compared again, let's say baseball, hockey, and football. Every year there's probably a surprise team or two in those leagues. Or not every year, but every so often. In basketball, almost virtually never. Now, a lot of that, as we've talked about, is there's five players, and when you have one or two superstars, they can dominate, even at that level. But what is your overall take, and is there any way, you know, to balance the league so there's more than, let's say, two, three, four teams at the beginning of the year you think has even a shot at winning the championship?
Well, I just say this year, I think there's definitely more than two or three more teams. I agree.
Yep.
It's not
first time in a while, probably.
First time
right?
in a while, yep. And it's nothing like the NFL. Dan and I talk about that a lot, where there truly is an any given Sunday notion. Mm-hmm. Although it's interesting when you step back, I think the Patriots have been in, you know, half the Super Bowls in the last 15 years.
That's true.
But people generally don't say that, the same notion about the NFL. And I think ultimately the issue is, can we create more parity in the NBA? I think undoubtedly, yes. I think there's, you know, we're constantly looking at how the CBA works, how the draft works, how the lottery works, and trying to find ways to better distribute players. I will say, though, and you made this point, Dan, in your question, that, I mean, face it, if LeBron James is on your team, you know, regardless of who's around him, mm-hmm. you know you're going to be in the playoffs, certainly.
Oh,
you know you're going to advance beyond that. And certain players in this league, it's you know, certain players are so extraordinary. And what's fascinating to me is that there's an enormous amount of basketball being played. We just said it, you know, there are 42 countries are represented, but there's basketball being played virtually in every spot on the planet. Hundreds of millions of people, the 400 very, very best all come to one league. 450 very best, not just talking about men, players in the world come into the NBA. And then there are, it's a pretty limited group. I'd say mm-hmm. 5-10 players who are difference makers, yeah. have that big an impact. I mean, you know, Arne Tellem, obviously, before he was president of Pistons, was a longtime NBA agent. And Arne and I used to speak to this a lot, too, even in terms of how the collective bargaining agreement works, because those players have so much value. And I would only say, to your point about creating more parity, the interesting issue is, I always say, if we played general manager and you took 450 trading cards representing all the players and said, all right, let's create the greatest amount of parity we can. We'll just put up a whiteboard and it would be hard to go beyond a certain, I don't know what that number would be. It definitely wouldn't be 30, because if you have one of those extraordinary players, it's why we need a lottery for our draft.
Right.
It's why, you know, the analytics suggest that rebuilding is so powerful in our league, because, and incidentally, I will only say, who those players are is not always as predictable as people think. I mean, it correlates to having a top draft pick, but Kawhi Leonard was the 15th pick in the draft.
Yeah.
Giannis Antetokounmpo was the 15th pick in the draft. Steph was the 7th pick in the draft. Now, obviously, LeBron comes along, and he was the first pick in the draft, and people predicted he was going to be great. You know, but, you know, Markelle Fultz from 2 years ago, the jury's still out.
I mean, and then there's also superstars on teams for years who don't win, too. You can make that argument. Let's talk about the lottery for just a minute, because we changed the odds this year, so we don't have so much of the, I guess, the tankathon or whatever they call it going on at the end of the year. And it's never really a tankathon. I think we all know that. Like, people think, I don't think anyway, I'm not aware of any team that's ever thrown a game, but there are things, injury players that are good come back from injury slower, or you don't make a trade you otherwise would have to win 5 or 7 more games. There's those kinds of things, right? So to sort of combat some of that, we changed the odds, right, where the number one team who had the most amount of losses has, what, a 25% chance of the number one pick? Ironically,
they used to have 25%.
Used to have it until this year. Now, sure, you want to wait one more year to implement that?
Well,
I was thinking maybe the resolution.
You know,
the,
I don't
you know.
Say there. So we roughly cut in half, you know, the chance of getting the first pick and made it even among the three teams with the worst performing records. And in order to reduce the incentive, frankly, to race to the bottom, you know, I'd only say there, it's always, we're balancing that against the utility of a draft, because at some point, if you're going to have a draft, presumably the purpose of the draft is to help the worst performing team progress. And that's the balance you're always trying to create in the league. I mean, you could move to a completely random draft lottery, and you could put all 30 teams in the hopper. But then if your championship team got the first pick, everyone would say, what's the whole point of a draft at all to do that? And so that's the balance. And we've tweaked the draft lottery probably 5 times now over the years to get to a better
fit. There's no perfect, right? There's no perfection.
It's not perfect. Yeah, I think one thing we can do, though, and we're seeing this a little bit, I don't think it's an accident now that you're seeing more top quality teams in the league, because I think as the pool of players on a global basis continues to grow, and the coaching, the focus on the sport of the best athletes at a young age continues to increase, we're seeing more great players in the league. I mean, that's one of my responses always to the sort of break up the Warriors notion, which, I mean...
Or break up the Warrior, like an antitrust suit.
Well, you hear that.
Or something.
And the notion, too, is, I mean, you know, as someone who competes in this league, it players' right as free agents to go where they go, and at the same time, you also want to celebrate excellence, and you think that even watching what's happened with the Warriors over the last few years sort of changed the style of play around the league, because other teams emulate that greatness, and in some ways you could say it's an emphasis on skill basketball, you know, quality shooting. Big men now in this league need to be able to shoot the ball as well. So I think at the same time you want competition around the league, but you don't you don't want to be in a position where you're not rooting for excellence at the same time.
Absolutely. You had just touched on it just now, but let's talk about the whole 18 versus 19-year-old. First of all, and what I'm saying for those who don't follow us that close is that for, I think, 12 or 13 years now, there's been the one-and-done rule in the NBA. In other words, you had to be through either your first year of college or 19 years old by a certain date to be eligible for the draft, or a year out of high school plus, right?
So essentially 19.
Essentially 19 years old. And so that makes players go to colleges, and they're primarily like 8 or 9 of the colleges that really get the vast majority of these players who primarily, for the vast majority, stay 1 year and they're done. And as all these systems, you know, they have their flaws no matter what you do. And now there's a whole, I guess, debate or decision or coming to a decision, or maybe there's one's been made. Tell everybody your thoughts on that, about does it, and does it matter, you know, we're making a big deal out of it, 1 year, 18 and 19, how much does that matter too?
We're talking about 1 year, you know, for roughly 10 players, call it. And I'd say that my view has changed on this, just in the period in which I've
since last week, or?
No, good. You know,
good. Since we may have to change some things we're doing if we don't, you know.
You know, as you know, when I became commissioner, we even talked at some of our board meetings that are, you know, comprised of all the team representatives, of even whether we should take the position that we should raise the age. You know, that we're at 19, we'd be better off with a minimum age of 20. I think, and there's no perfect solution here, like to a lot of the issues we've talked about, but I think as we've been watching sort of what's been happening in college basketball the last few years, including a special commission that was formed by Mark Emmert, the head of the NCAA, chaired by Condoleezza Rice, in which they
is she the new coach of the Browns or no? No?
No? She may
read that, yeah.
But that her commission, which was comprised of college presidents, former NBA players, college administrators, college coaches, and ultimately their recommendation was that we return to a minimum age of 18. And that we allow these championship, these top-notch players to come directly out of high school. And I think also, so, you know, it's Condoleezza Rice made that recommendation, and then President Obama has spoken out on this issue as well, and his recommendation that there be a professional track for those elite players. I think from an NBA standpoint, I mean, it's no secret, when we're in the room with our general managers, with our owners, people, I think, are roughly split. I think some, certainly if you get one of those top picks and you're in a position of drafting, and you can choose between seeing a player come directly out of high school or having the benefit of seeing that player play against top-notch college competition for a year or even possibly 2 years, your preference is always going to be to have seen that player play for a little longer. I think counterbalancing that from a league standpoint is whether that player is drafted first or fifth or 10th, that player is still coming into the NBA. So when you look at it as a league-wide issue, it changes the perspective a little bit. I think number two, the business of college sports has frankly gotten so big where I think USA Today published a statistic last year, it's probably even greater at this point, that there are 351 Division I programs, and over 50 of the coaches of those programs make over $2 million a year just in salary. It's, you know, all this is public. There's a, you know, multi-billion dollar television contract for the NCAA, and I think it's any market where you, you know, you attempt to distort a market by placing a condition, for example, that you can't pay the athletes, it just creates enormous pressure, frankly, for corruption. And that's what we're seeing now around college sports. And there's just, you know, a trial with some convictions that just took place in the Southern District and New York. So one, you're seeing the corruption around it. And I think also there's a sense from people involved in the NBA and college that if these players are in a position where they can generate this kind of money, maybe they should be paid. And I think within the college system, putting aside a principle to say they should be compensated directly, I think logistically, how would that even work with, do you pay them all the same? Do you pay certain players more? Do you pay the women the same as the men? How do you deal with non-revenue producing sports?
It all sounds great until you get to the details.
Well, right, exactly. So just to, and then to get the answer to your question, so it's led me now where I feel we should return to a minimum age of 18. I will say, though, it's not, and this goes to the other part of your question, it's not up to the league unilaterally to make that decision. It has to be collectively bargained with our Players Association. So we have
What's the next step?
Well, so
I got,
next step,
I got two, I'm getting the minute. Right, so I got two more quick questions.
I'll finish this answer.
I have to get
so
in.
So we could wait till the end of our collective bargaining agreement is over, which is roughly another 5 years, and sit down with the players and negotiate it over. Or, as we've openly talked about, a collective bargaining agreement is like no other, is like any other contract or agreement, and you could amend it. So we've gone to our players' association and said, let's sit down, because this is, historically, this was an issue they were always in favor of, you know, of an 18-year-old minimum age. And so we went to them and said, maybe we should just discreetly bargain over this one issue and see if we can come to an agreement. And so rather than waiting to the end of the agreement, sooner rather than later, we can move to 18, which would still require a transition from 19 to 18. So that's where it currently stands.
So what's it going to be, 18 or 9? We're going to know until after the CBA, right?
The view now is, although it's a close issue, on balance we should return to 18, but we have to negotiate it with the players' association.
Okay, great. Two quick questions. They say I have 1 minute. I think we can do it in 90 seconds, or give me an extra overtime minute. Okay, what's the overtime in the NBA? It's 5 minutes, so it's an overtime game. Sports gambling. Let's talk about sports gambling. You're one of the few commissioners, and this is what I really, in all due respect for you, you know, you do not have any problem taking a stance on things. I mean, as nice of a tone, as nice of a guy that you are, and you are, but man, what an example you are as a leader for people, because you will take stances that, whether they're popular or not, you weigh it all, and what a perfect person to be the commissioner. So tell everybody why you came out first on gambling and in favor of sports gambling and what you think of it as the future.
Sure, well, you know, I would say I appreciate you saying those things, but it wasn't in a vacuum. It was talking to lots of people like you, especially who have an interest in a gaming company and understand the
business. Not so many anymore, though, you know.
Well, But so in 2014, shortly after I became commissioner, you know, I actually wrote an opinion piece that ended up getting published in the New York Times, and it said that I think at this point we should legalize sports betting nationally. I mean, of course, it's been legal in Nevada for almost 70 years now, so there was a pocket where it was legal. But I thought essentially what had happened was that the internet had disrupted that industry the same way it's disrupted probably everybody else's industry who's in this room, and that where we were in a position just a few years ago where if you went to the internet and you put in bet NBA into Google, you could see, you could spend a week looking at the number of sites that, well, called a gray area of the law, but it didn't stop little credit card logos from being next to those sites. And clearly, there was an enormous amount being bet illegally on sports. Estimates were up to four, and continue to be up to $400 billion a year, just in the United States, illegally bet on sports. And from the sports league standpoint, or speaking for the NBA, the view was, you'd much prefer, obviously, to have transparency in that market. Part of it, I always analogize it to a stock exchange. And if you think, again, anybody who's in the finance business, if there is irregular activity in a public market, it gets investigated. If there is a merger that gets announced on November 20th and November 19th, there's a lot of stock movement, the exchange will look at everyone who bought and sold on that date to see whether there's an insider. If there's someone who just opened an account that day, they'll knock on their door and say, why'd you decide to buy that stock that day when you hadn't traded in that stock previously? So number one, from integrity standpoint for a league, that we're in a much better position to protect ourselves against illegal activity, the equivalent of insider trading, if there's transparency in the market. And number two, and I always want to say this because I don't want to hide from it, I think it would be also good for business. That I think there's no doubt that if people bet and bet, you know, in ways that are within their means and do it for entertainment, that it increases engagement in your sport. I mean, I always say that, you know, I'm not allowed to bet on sports as the commissioner of the NBA, but if I go to a Super Bowl party, and even if it's not your team, and somebody has one of those fun games, and you're, you know, putting $5 or $20 on a box, and it's sort of a score, and you're all in on that game in a way you wouldn't be. Yeah. And just in the same way that, you know, you're involved in the gaming business, I mean, you have to make sure you take every possible precaution to deal potentially with problem gamblers. And I don't want to understate that issue. It's potentially a problem, just as potential overuse of alcohol is a problem, or other substances in our society. But I think, again, it's another one of these issues that net, you know, I think it's better off to regulated. I didn't even mention the tax potential tax revenue that comes from it again. And it also puts the league in a much better place to protect itself. So the last piece of it, which is something, again, we both went to law school, but I never would have predicted when I wrote that op-ed piece in 2014 that 6 months ago the Supreme Court would take a law that had been on the books since 1992, was sponsored by the great Bill Bradley, you know, who was then a senator from New Jersey, and the Supreme Court decided 26 years later that that law that prohibited sports betting, with the exception of Nevada and a few other small exceptions, was now unconstitutional. Right. So that opened up the field for state by state regulation of sports betting. There's 7 states now that have legalized it. I know here in Michigan, there is a lot of interest in it. I understand when the session begins after the holidays, it'll be on the docket again. And I know in Ohio as well, they're going to consider it.
I think both states, as well as many others, like you said. And so one last question, and then I think we're supposed to go to Q&A here. But this, because this is sort of pertinent to this audience here, as well as Cleveland and others. So the Pistons moving downtown Detroit, to downtown Detroit, they were the last team that was not in the urban core out of all 30 NBA teams, 29 arenas, because Lakers and Clippers play in the same one. So out of 29 arenas, now all 29 are in urban cores. And we talked about this in Cleveland. I think it would be great for the people of Detroit to hear this. This tie between the urban core and the NBA game or the basketball game, you talked about that, and I think that's...
Dan, I'd love for you to talk about this too, but, you know, so, you know, and Dave can also speak to this, and people around the NBA for a long time, I'd say there was a flight out of cities at one period in this league in the 70s, you know, partially in the 80s, where, you know, it was a sort of a breakdown of a lot of the cities in America, and the teams moved out into the suburbs, and I think it sort of was inconsistent with the DNA of our game in many ways, and we very much are a city game. And also, it was a national trend where there was a lot of issues, I mean, not just here in Detroit, but in the city I grew up in New York, or, you know, around the country, where cities were struggling for in all kinds of ways. And I think it was, in many ways, symbolic to see our sports teams come back into the inner core, to your point, of these great American cities. And I also say that these arenas have become modern day town halls in these cities and represent in many ways the perfect public-private partnership, because unlike, for example, in the case of an NFL stadium, where maybe there's a few outdoor concerts, but in essence that stadium is there for the football team, in the case of the NBA, I mean, if a team is fortunate enough to get to the playoffs, you know, maybe we represent roughly 50 dates, maybe a little more with some preseason games. But these great arenas in our country, I mean, they're often full 300 dates a year, and it's concerts. You know, maybe there's a hockey team, obviously, here in town as well. Other ice shows, circuses, you know, political conventions, graduations. I mean, these are gathering places for people in cities. And again, and what we've also seen in with the return to the urban core is an enormous amount of development around these arenas. And that's something we didn't see at the last wave. Arenas were, in essence, standalone. And now, I mean, they become places where people plan their nights around them. And it's not just within the arena. Restaurants, in some cases, casinos nearby, all kinds of other commercial activity. Sometimes now hotels are being built around our arenas, residential housing. So they are truly an economic engine. And most recently, I was just, you know, a month ago or so, whenever it was, I was in Milwaukee for the opening of their brand new arena in downtown. Another perfect example, and also where other NBA owners like Dan, who are in many businesses, we saw there where the ownership group also is investing in the real estate around the arena, where, you know, in that case, there one of the team partners is a real estate developer, and he's really invested himself in revitalizing downtown Milwaukee, and it comes at great risk and enormous capital that's being invested. I think sometimes that gets underappreciated, but they use these arenas as anchor tenants and with enormous development around it. So it's been a great trend throughout America, and we're seeing the success here in Detroit as well.
Yeah, and you're seeing that in Detroit, and they're just really probably starting to put that development together, and it takes some time, you know, sometimes. Just like we do, we all hit bumps in the road, but that's going to be an unreal development. They're totally committed here. Red Wings, the Pistons, the Ilitch family, I think it's going to be, and by the way, we're in their building right now. we're in the, you know, if we didn't sell it last week, I wouldn't have done it here, but, you know, just kidding. But you know, they're like you said, heavily invested in Detroit, and we see it in Milwaukee, Cleveland, especially in the Midwest or some of the inside
coast cities. And even the new building in Sacramento, for example.
That too,
yep. I mean, that they, you know, when former NBA great Kevin Johnson was the mayor of that town, and when there was a threat that the team was going to leave, I mean, they put together a community group, again, public-private partnership, and built a beautiful brand new arena in downtown Sacramento. Of course, California's capital, but the downtown was empty, and there was yep. It was built around a shopping center that, and you know, it seemed like half the stores when I toured it before they built the new arena were had been vacated, and now it's vibrant, a new hotel, commercial development, residential. It's exactly what everyone's hoping.
One thing builds on the next. I could probably sit up here for 3 hours with you talking. I don't know if anybody would be left, but we would definitely talk and go. So I guess we're supposed to throw it out to this crowd here for questions. So I guess, what are they supposed to just raise your hand? We'll just go front row.
Yeah. Your local weatherman gave me the forecast for
Now. is the barometer between 29 and 30 today?
We got some snow later on tonight.
Okay. Yeah. Besides that.
He told me flurries. He said, what time is your plane?
Okay. Make sure to take care of you at the airport. But watch Channel 4. I'll give you the
weather. Thank you very
much. Back to college-age players and whether or not they get paid. Is there a critical mass of the number of college-age players if they decide opting out of going to college and instead going into an international league, or if they have some sort of entrepreneurial spirit, decide to combine any sort of business talent with their athletic talent? Is there a certain amount of numbers if they opt to do that where you rethink your position about whether or not college players get paid?
Well, you know, number one, my position, you know, it's for colleges, obviously, to decide whether to pay college players. You know, my issue is more, you know, should we be offering an alternative path to those players to come directly into the NBA? I mean, that's a decision those players, their parents, their coaches, their guardians, whatever, have to make about what the right choice is for those players. I should have mentioned also, long-winded enough, but this is to add to my already long answer. Well, we have to negotiate with the Player Association to move the minimum age from 19 to 18. In the case of our development league, which is our G League, we've always allowed players to come directly from high school at 18. One of the changes we made, though, and actually this was in response to one of the things that Dan had told me, and this was a suggestion that we increase the salaries for those players. Initially, we increased the salaries for those G League players to $35,000 last year, again, at Dan's suggestion, but then we went a step further. We made an announcement, you know, a little while ago that beginning next season, for a select group of high school players who can't go into the NBA yet because we still have a minimum age at 19, but want to play professionally, we're going to have a $125,000 a year track for those players. Just to create, again, and I'm not even saying, wouldn't be saying to those young players that this is necessarily a better alternative than going to one of those top schools that Dan mentioned where a lot of the one and done players are going. I would just say it's an alternative path, and it may not be for everyone, but again, we want to create optionality for those players. And as part of that track coming directly into the G League, again, and this is for an elite player that if they remain on that course, is very likely not only to get drafted in the NBA, but be a high draft pick the next year, that, you know, it would be a holistic approach. We would also be offering courses for those players, you know, life skills, you know, money management courses, all those kinds of things so that they can get some life experience. But it's sort of built into your question. Some players, because we're still at 19, have elected to go play in Europe for a year. One player went to China and played for a year. It's difficult, though, I would say, for these young players to come directly out of, in essence, high school basketball and just being thrust into truly a grown men's league. And because many of those country leagues, the players may not be as skilled as some of these young players, but they're big grown men. It's a much more physical game. And it's also tough to be alone and to travel across the world if that's the first time you're leaving home. So, again, we just the focus is on optionality.
So the G League, which used to be called the D League, which, you know,
is for Gatorade.
Gatorade, right? What was D for?
Development.
Oh, okay, that's right. Development. It's just you don't want to say where you play. I'm in the D League. That's just one notch from the E League. I mean, you know, G League is much better.
Dan also made that suggestion.
But then you sold it to Gatorade. So, okay, or sold the rights to Gatorade. Do you ever, like, when you're standing up like that, do you ever, like, want to break up into like a high pressure system coming from your hands are moving. I mean, I'm just curious if you know.
I need a green screen.
Oh, okay. All right. I was just curious. Okay. Let's go. I can't see the young lady here. Right there. Yep.
Thank you. Hi, Commissioner.
Hi.
My name is Bernadette, and my question alludes to something you just talked about a couple of minutes ago. Many, if not most, corporations have a social responsibility platform. And you work in a field that has certainly had a very visible presence in social justice movements throughout the decades. So what is your advice to businesses about strategies to employ to, one, make decisions about positions to take and how to make those positions effective?
Well, that's a great question. You know, and I begin by saying our platform is NBA Cares. And what's interesting, and I don't know if you find the same thing, Dan, with your company, but when we survey our own employees, employees of the league, and we say, what are you most proud about being associated with the NBA? NBA Cares is the top of the list virtually in every survey we do. And I think especially for young employees these days, they want to be associated with an employer that stands for something. And so even just the marketplace will drive you there, even if it's not necessarily a place that you're comfortable being. And I'd say in terms of positions to take, and again, this is something that Dan and I and a lot of team owners have had lots of discussions about, and I think we look to take positions that frankly are values-based, and I recognize that everything is political these days, but I think in terms, like one of the core principles that has underlied this league since the very beginning, and again, part of our DNA, is equality. And I think when we've seen things that have happened, certainly in some states that we've operated in, some cities that we felt were inconsistent with those core values, we felt that we had to speak out. And
We saw you do it, right?
Right. Well, we moved an All-Star game out of North Carolina.
That too. Yeah.
And also on the owner that you mentioned before. And yeah. I think, like to me, although, you know, it's interesting, even as Dan said, that even something that seemed as straightforward as that decision with that particular owner, it was still very divisive nationally. You know, a lot of people's view was, you know, the equivalent of shut up and dribble, you know, was even to the commissioner that's none of your business what somebody chooses to say, you know, outside the four corners of the court. But I think it was my view, and it shared by ownership in this league, that it does reflect who we are as a league and the core principles that we operate under. And I would just say my advice, and I've had this discussion with other, you know, CEOs and other leaders, is that I think even if people may disagree with you, it's critically important that you're completely transparent. And I found that one of the ways that I've always approached it is to be willing to explain to people exactly how we see the issue and how we arrive at our ultimate decision. I find if you do that, you sort of can agree on a common set of facts, a common set of principles. At the end, well-meaning people may ultimately conclude that you should make a different decision, but I find they'll respect you at least for the process you underwent and the decision you make. And I think that, and the listening part gets undervalued. And I think that I travel a lot in this job. I mean, 30 NBA teams, internationally a fair amount as well. And I'm doing all the talking today, but often when I'm sitting in stands or just going around, I'm mainly listening. And when, you know, I think that, and often people come up to me and say, I respect you, but I disagree with the decision you made and some of the high profile things we've done. And, you know, often, you know, it's like so many things we deal with, their points are well taken in terms of different principles involving speech or principles involving, you know, a different political belief about how to approach an issue. But when I say, I understand it, here are the underpinnings of our decision, here are the values. And again, as I always say, I don't personalize it to my values. I mean, I think my values are consistent with the league's values, but these values come from Dave Bing and great players that came even before Dave and came before David Stern. And that when I, you know, I always talk about the fact that, you know, the great Bill Russell, he, you know, stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial when Dr. King was giving his I Have a Dream speech. I mean, that, and he made that decision then when it seems today, boy, that shouldn't be controversial to stand and listen to Dr. King giving a speech. But he then was subject to an enormous amount of racism
everywhere he went as a result of that, what seemed like a political association, and I would at least call a values-driven association today. So,
if I could just add one thing, I don't believe there's any conflict between the moral, ethical stance and actually the well-being of the company or the business or the nonprofit or whatever it might be, because ultimately, at the end of the day, people know and can see through decisions that are made without transparency and that you're trying to, and that probably bothers them worse than the actual decision that you're trying to make them think you made a decision for some other reason, which is nobody believes that stuff. So, I mean, to your credit, you come right out and you take the stance, which is the value stance based on the values. And, you know, we have this philosophy called, you know, for more than profit. We want to be for more than profit as a business. Now, that doesn't mean we don't make profits. In fact, I'll contend to anybody, we make more profits because of it, because we're attracting the best and brightest who want to be part of that, and a diverse group of the best and brightest. So, you know, I think that old model is really starting to fall down. And somebody, you reminded me at the Cleveland interview, you said that, I couldn't remember the name then and I can't remember it now, you'll probably tell me, but somebody wrote an article recently about if businesses do not adopt, you know, that kind of approach, they're going to be in trouble and not going to be able to compete based on today's world.
I don't even remember that article, but I certainly
Then that's, maybe it wasn't you. I was
no, but I agree with that principle. No, it's critically, and by the way, like even sort of retail businesses, because of the internet, because of YouTube, because of the prevalence of high quality smartphone cameras, like everything is now, you know, is on display for the world. And if you don't treat one customer well and you're a major national brand, you're at risk that becomes a global incident because you were rude to one customer. And, and I know that you guys win customer, you know, performance awards every year, but it's because, and I've sat through your ISMS classes in all seriousness, and it's something that's when Dan addresses his new employees, that's what he chooses to talk to them about the values of the company. You know, somebody else can go through the operations manual, but yours is values-based.
Yeah, so anyway, we could talk so long about it. Was that one more minute or one more question? One more question. Okay, one more question. Do you want to, you have to pick the, okay.
Is that, gentleman right here, I think.
Is that who you want, right here? Here? I can't see out here. These lights are right in my, it's hard to see. Okay.
Gentlemen, how's it going?
Good,
yep.
Thank you.
How you doing?
Thanks for speaking today, first and foremost. The question I wanted to ask is, across the pond in Canada, and Dan, you can maybe speak a little bit more about this, you did just make a substantial investment in downtown Windsor, but from an NBA standpoint, the Toronto Raptors, you could say, have a full country behind them. Do you think more expansion into Canada might be an option in the future, or Kevin Durant's been pretty vocal about this, but a Seattle team is in play, whether or not this behind closed doors?
You heard the Canadian accent, so be careful.
Well, I did. But I do want to remind our esteemed Canadian that it is a river, not a pond, just for the record. Okay, go ahead. We did just buy dictionary.com, so I'm trying to, you know. So,
you know. It's interesting. We had two teams in Canada at one point. We expanded to both Toronto and Vancouver, and, you know, we had a particular owner who moved that team from Vancouver to
One quick question that I've been meaning to ask you this, or somebody this, maybe Dave knows this. How could the Memphis, how did they not change the name? There's no, are there Grizzlies in Memphis?
Not that I'm aware.
Okay, I'm just curious.
So I would say, you know, one of the arrangements we made with the Toronto Raptors is that, you know, I think of our system in the U.S. as sort of like a federalistic system with the states, and it's like states' rights that, you know, Pistons have the right to this geographical territory, and more nationally, the Cleveland National Territory. In the case of the Raptors, initially, they just had that province, and we went in with their control governor, Larry Tannenbaum, and we said, you're in a much better position to market to all of Canada than the league office is, because you understand the market better and people are more likely to get behind your team. Not that we don't want people throughout Canada to have the opportunity to root for any team we want. And that's been a very successful model. And one of the things, you know, we were talking about international expansion. I mean, we don't generally think as much about Canada in terms of international expansion, but we now have, I think, roughly a dozen Canadian players in the NBA, and truly high quality players. And what's interesting, when you look at the statistics now about young people playing sports, it's quite remarkable to me the progress that basketball has made compared to the national religion, hockey. And so you're seeing a lot of basketball being played, and so there's no doubt there's, to me, a strong correlation. You know, a lot of people credit Vince Carter sort of with Vinsanity in his early days there, and sort of just, you know, people falling in love with the game around him, you know, and Tracy McGrady. But, you know, there's no immediate plans to expand anywhere at the moment. I mean, I think I have nothing. We love Memphis, but I wish we hadn't moved from Vancouver. In retrospect, I think that would have also continued to be a great market. But at least now we're just very focused on
I will tell you, too, that Toronto is one of the most underrated, like, loud, just passionate stadiums. And we played them in the playoffs the last, I think, 3 years in a row. I mean, it is one of the loudest places in the league. You hear that about, you know, Cleveland sometimes, Golden State sometimes. You hear about Sacramento sometimes in the old, I guess, the old building. But Toronto, they're a little, they get a little crazy in Toronto. You know, I think the drinking age is lower there, isn't it? Something,
yeah. I think that's, it's so better just, beer.
Yeah, that maybe just occurred to me.
Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Adam Silver, Dan Gilbert, thank you. Okay, guys, so we appreciate your business perspectives and your perspectives on social impacts. We want to learn a little bit about you personally. So are you ready for the lightning round? Quick, rapid fire, here we go. We're going to start with Adam.
No,
you want to start with Dan? All right, yeah. Dan, something on your bucket list.
Wait, aren't you the, I don't know who's the visiting team, but you might be.
Something on your bucket list.
Yes.
That's a short, thank you for following instructions. That's a short answer. Adam Silver, something on your bucket list?
You don't have to answer?
No, I said yes. He asked me if there's something on my, oh, you want to know specifically?
Yes.
Oh, I'm very grammatically
you're very
correct
literal. Okay.
Today.
You own dictionary.com, right?
You know,
so, I mean, there's probably a few things. I mean, just one of them is to see, you know, this city become the city of choice for businesses and for kids coming out of any university, any school, and that there's a job available and a career and a path available for every person born and raised in the city, and that this is just one of the places where it's happening. From no matter where you are, you're gonna, you know, Detroit's gonna be on your short list.
Try following that, Adam Silver.
I'm gonna give the non-serious answer. I'd only say, you know, I was thinking of your jersey sponsor is Goodyear. I've always wanted to ride in a blimp. Maybe you can hook me up.
Wednesday night we're playing the Lakers. Come on. We'll get you one.
All right, back to Adam. Person you'd like to have lunch with and why?
Is that living by definition?
Your choice.
Winston Churchill.
Although it would be hard to have lunch with someone not living, but Okay, so I would say, well, first of all, I was fortunate enough to have lunch with somebody who I always wanted to, and that was Warren Buffett. And, you know, he said something really interesting that was pertinent, I think, to your question over there. And he said, you know, I'm optimistic about America for the next hundred years, let's say. And I said, well, you know, what's the reason for that? He said, well, if you think about it, we've done all this stuff basically a undeveloped country to what we've developed now in 200 something years, and only half of the population, or less than half. He said something like, when you take into account ethnic and women and all that, we've done it with pretty much about 35 or 40% of the population. He says now 100% of the population participates in all that brain power and all that work ethic and all that, you know, passion and all that. Just think of this, where this country is going to be. And I just really hit me. I never thought of it that way, of course, because that's why he's Warren Buffett. Then he charges $20 million for that insurance, but it's another issue. He was unbelievable. And so I would say that was it, and I was able to check that one off.
Awesome. Adam, your choice, one of your favorite movies or a favorite song?
Princess Bride. You know, I'm just thinking that the screenwriter, in all seriousness, I just read his obituary. The New York Times, William Goldman, I think just died a few days ago. So it's one of my favorite movies.
Well, favorite
Dan,
movie?
Dan, favorite movie or song, your choice.
What was the second one, song?
Song.
I'll go with the movie for 400.
What do you got?
I want to say A Few Good Men, you know, because, I don't know, I just can do that whole Jack Nicholson, you know, sleep under a blanket of freedom and question the manner in which I provide, all that stuff. So, you know. It was just such an intense courtroom scene. We at work, we watch it probably every few months just for the heck of it, you know?
This one's going to be easier for Dan than it is Adam, but let's start with Adam. Describe Detroit in one word.
comeback?
One word, I'd say grit.
Love it. And now this one is your final question of the day. We'll start with Adam. Advice to your 25-year-old self.
Take more risk than I did.
To my 25-year-old self? Oh, man, I got a list. First of all, don't write that stupid letter in 2010. there's a few. How long you got here? Let's keep going. So.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, one more time, Adam Silver and Dan Gilbert.
Thank you.
Thank you both for choosing the Detroit Economic Club. Ladies and gentlemen, you are all invited to immediately join us for a strolling reception in the soundboard out the door and to the left. I'm going to challenge you to meet someone you didn't know before you arrived today. Thank you again. This meeting of the Detroit Economic Club is adjourned.